This is The Takeaway for Wednesday, October 11th, 2017.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Sarah Gonzalez. Todd Zwillick is back tomorrow. We begin in Northern California.
I grew up here in Sonoma County. I've lived here most of my life, and I almost can't describe what I'm seeing. The sky is this weird yellow-gray color. There's ash falling everywhere. The smoke is really thick. The sun is a funny color, and, you know, the devastation is just beyond understanding.
Heather Bailey is co-owner of Phoenix Farms in Healdsburg, California. She was forced to evacuate from her home, and we'll hear more from her in just a minute. More than 15 wildfires that started on Sunday night are still blazing across Northern California. At least 17 people have been killed, hundreds are hospitalized, and about 180 people are still missing. The fires have ripped through more than 100,000 acres, destroying 2,000 homes and businesses. About 25,000 evacuees are still waiting to learn if anything more than ashes remain of their homes. President Trump approved California Governor Jerry Brown's request for federal aid and declared a major disaster. Here's the president in remarks to reporters on Tuesday.
Napa has been hit so hard, and Sonoma, as they deal with the tragic loss of life and property to devastating wildfires. I spoke with Governor Brown last night to let him know that the federal government will stand with the people of California, and we will be there for you in this time of terrible tragedy and need.
Here to discuss the latest on Northern California's wildfires is KQED News anchor Mina Kim. Mina Kim is in Napa, California. Hi, Mina.
Hi.
Mina, you've been covering the wildfires nonstop for the past 24 hours. Schools and hospitals, wineries and mobile home parks have been destroyed. You live in Napa yourself. You're there now, and the evacuation line is creeping toward you, as I understand.
Yes, it's about two major roads away from me right now. I wish I could say that this situation is improving, but in the last 12 hours, it's taken a bit of a turn. The fires have actually intensified here in Napa, particularly on the west end of the city, the northwest end of the city where I am. And that's why the evacuation zone got closer to me within the last 12 hours. And it still remains a life-saving operation where firefighters basically are not putting or not able to, I guess is a better way to put it, to put their efforts toward putting out the fire, but really much more focused on saving lives.
The president has announced federal support. FEMA has also pledged funds to fight the fires. And yesterday, the California National Guard started to aid first responders in battling some of the fires. What is the local and federal response and recovery looking like on the ground?
Well, we're certainly going to need all of that. As of right now, the update that we got from the local county fire chief, the Cal Fire chief here, was that even though there is a great deal of mutual aid and there are more resources coming in both state and nationally, there are firefighters who are having to do multiple back-to-back shifts. So there is a lot of fatigue. I've been hearing from neighbors who have wineries or homes in the hills and mountain ranges, and they're wondering why they're not seeing more air support. So even though, yes, help is on the way, I don't think at this point anyone is really feeling a significant change for the better.
And this has been an intense wildfire season in the western region of the United States. More than 8 million acres have been burned. These fires spread unusually fast. They caught some residents off guard who had to flee on foot, which I can't even imagine. What made these fires spread so quickly?
It was the wind. The wind was so fast. It was going up to 60, in some cases 70 miles per hour. It was blowing embers everywhere. That's what started multiple fires in multiple locations that almost, you know, felt like a giant half ring for a bit around various cities in the two counties of Sonoma and Napa. And the wind still remains the major factor. I mean, it really is a question of where the wind blows. That's we're really at the mercy of that. And unfortunately, it's predicted that the winds will pick up significantly. Also, you mentioned that we've had a really bad wildfire season. the Cal Fire state chief was saying that while multiple fires are not unheard of, they're becoming much more the norm these days.
Wildfires don't qualify for federal disaster funding, although the president can approve grants. So, Mina, how can our listeners help those in need right now? Where do people who are still searching for loved ones turn to?
Well, that's one thing that's been really hard. The connectivity has been really hard here. We have really limited cell service, but they are asking, there are disaster relief funds. I know locally here in Napa, the Napa Community Foundation has set up a disaster relief fund. People can also check for updates on loved ones at safeandwell.org. And, you know, they are looking for volunteers in the Sonoma area, in particular at the evacuation centers there. It's just, it's still very much a volatile situation.
All right. KQED News anchor Mina Kim, thank you so much for joining us and good luck out there.
Thank you.
We return to Heather Bailey now. Bailey is the co-owner of Phoenix Farms in Healdsburg, California. And she says, despite spending her entire life in Sonoma County in California, which is known for its wildfires, these fires have reached a scale she hasn't ever witnessed before.
I've certainly never been through anything like this. This is unlike anything I've ever seen before because most of the fires that we deal with are wildland type fires. But the way that this has burned through these residential neighborhoods and taken so many houses is just unbelievable. I was involved in helping out with the Valley Fire 2 years ago, which is in the neighboring county, Lake County, from here. And that was horrific for sure. And there was certainly loss of life and loss of homes. But that geography compared to the number of homes and things taken here is there's no comparison. I just can't imagine how many people have lost their homes.
You live in an unincorporated area of Sonoma on a farm. How and when did you evacuate?
My day started at about midnight on Sunday night or Monday morning, however you'd like to call it. A neighbor called on my cell phone and she said, the hills are glowing, we got to get out. And I sat up and looked, and indeed the hills were glowing, and I have a small child, so my first thought was to get my child out, and my original plan was to go to my parents' house. They live in a different part of Sonoma County, and unfortunately, as we started to drive over there with my son to take him to his grandparents, the closer we got, the more we realized that the fire was actually much closer to them than to us. So by the time we got there, we ended up evacuating them instead of us evacuating to them. We still don't know if their house has survived. It's in one of the areas that was the hardest hit, so we are concerned about that. But then, so we went back home and stayed up all night watching the fire and watching the fire maps. And I'm lucky that the man that works for me is a former Cal firefighter. And he stayed with us in the morning, and there came a point yesterday morning where he sort of turned to us and said, all right, I think we need to go. So he said, the fire will be here today. So that was the point when we started to get everybody out.
And you have farm animals. I imagine you evacuated them or tried to evacuate them as well?
Yes, it was quite an undertaking. We have 22 horses here. I have 21 goats here. I have around 20 chickens, 4 dogs, 2 mules, and a donkey. Thankfully, we were able to get almost all of them out. I had to leave a few chickens behind. I wasn't able to get them all rounded up the way I would have hoped to, but they all the rest of them got out. We did get them all out. It took a huge effort and a huge caravan from friends and complete strangers to get all those animals out of there.
You must be so worried. Do you know if your home will be standing when you return?
I do not. We're going to be trying to make our way back both to our property, and then I'm going to try to go over to my parents' property and see if it's still standing as well. At this point, we don't know.
And have you thought about what the plan would be if your home and your parents' home is not standing?
To be honest, I kind of haven't let myself go there. Mm-hmm. Because it's such a, you know, for my parents, you know, who are older and that house has really been sort of their life's work. I can't imagine what it would feel like for them to have to start over. And for myself, you know, having all these animals, it's not like I could just go rent an apartment until things are fixed. So I, at this moment, I guess I'm just sort of hoping and wishing and crossing all my fingers and toes that I won't have to figure that out. But, you know, at the same time, when you have animals, that's the responsibility that you live with, and whatever comes is what's going to come, and we'll just hope for the best and make it work somehow.
Have you heard from your neighbors?
So I haven't heard. I mean, we live pretty far out in the country, so our neighbors all live pretty far away. Nobody's been able to get back down our road to see how everybody's places have done. I do know that two of the areas in Santa Rosa that have been really devastated, one is an area called Coffee Park. That's definitely more on the lower to mid-income areas, and they have just been terribly devastated by this fire. I also know that two sort of senior living mobile home parks were pretty badly destroyed also. And then, you know, on the flip side, the Fountain Grove area, which was also really badly hit, that's probably sort of a different, you know, economical demographic. But that's what's striking me here when I think about it, is that everybody has been devastated. No matter where sort of on the income strata you fall, this has been a devastating 24 hours.
Okay, Heather Bailey, thank you so much for joining us. I'm sorry that you're going through this, and I hope your home is fine when you get back.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Heather Bailey is co-owner of Phoenix Farms in Healdsburg, California. Sarah Gonzalez here on The Takeaway today. More women are speaking out against movie mogul Harvey Weinstein after the New York Times expose this weekend. The New Yorker has now added to the picture, reporting allegations that include rape and releasing a recording captured during a New York Police Department sting operation in which Weinstein admits to groping a woman.
Just sit with me. Don't embarrass me in the hotel. I'm here all the time.
I
sit
know,
with me.
But
I promise.
Don't want to.
Please sit there. Please. Mm-hmm. 1 minute.
No,
I ask
I can't.
You. Go to the bathroom.
Please, I don't want to do something I don't want
go
to.
Go to the bathroom. Come here.
Along with the allegations, another story unfolds. The fact that the harassment and assaults have been happening for decades. After years of censorship and payouts to cover up the allegations, why are these women's stories only now being reported? We spoke to one journalist who faced the pressure to back off a story about Weinstein.
I'm Paula Froelich. I was the deputy editor of Page Six for 10 years. I'm a journalist and I'm the founder of AbroadAbroad.com.
This was her experience.
It was in 2000. It was for a party for Karen Duffy's book, and all of New York media was there. And all of a sudden, there's a skirmish breaking out. I was around it when it happened. Rebecca Traister had asked Harvey something about his anger issues because they had been bubbling up as of late. And he called her a very bad word that started with a C. Andrew Goldman, who had been dating Rebecca at the time, they both worked for The Observer, stood up for her and he said, "Hey, you can't talk to her like that." He threw Andrew across the room into a table and then got him into a headlock, jammed him out the front doors onto the street, screaming, "I'm the bleeping sheriff of this bleeping lawless bleeping town." I went into work the next day and I called up Matthew Hiltzik, the PR guy for Harvey at the time. I said, "All right, let's talk about last night." And he goes, "You know, let's talk about last night." And he basically said, "You know, you don't need to do it. You don't need to do this piece." And I go, "Ha, ha, ha, yes, I do. And besides, if I don't do it, someone else is going to do it. They were all there." He goes, "No, no, no. I've spoken to them all, and they've all promised that they're not going to do anything." So I ended up writing the story. I ran it past them. I started getting calls from a Fox News reporter begging me not to do the story. My boss starts going, "I don't know if we should do this story." And I literally looked at him and I said, "If you don't do the story, I quit." I said, okay, fine. So I wrote the story as what actually happened. And the actual story that came out the next day looked nothing like it.
I asked Paula Froelich about the open secret of Weinstein's abuse.
Everyone knew about these assault accusations. It was an open secret. And it was an open secret that was allowed to stay secret for so long because how are you going to fight against that? I mean, it was such an open secret that Seth MacFarlane made an open joke about it in the Oscars in 2013 when introducing the best supporting actresses.
"Congratulations, you five ladies no longer have to pretend to be attracted to Harvey Weinstein."
It was such an open joke that Tina Fey wrote a joke about it in 30 Rock.
"I'm not afraid of anyone in show business. I turned down intercourse with Harvey Weinstein on no less than 3 occasions out of 5.
And by joke, it was not a joke, but people were making jokes about it. The problem is that even, you know, people are like, the media, the watchdog, all that. Yeah, well, if I'm not there and I don't see it happen, I have to rely on a source to tell me. Now, that source is going to get slammed down by lawyers if you don't come from a lot of money, if you're not like, I don't know, some billionaire's daughter, how are you going to afford that lawyer? And you're not going to, and it's a bully tactic. Then the next thing you know, all of a sudden, you start watching stuff happen in press in other areas of leaks about this other person. We all knew the story. You can't back it up until something like this happens. And what actually happened, it is my belief, and in the New York Post already wrote about it, so I'm happy to say it. You know, the New York Post just wrote that Bob Weinstein, you know, must have sold out his brother. People from within the company sold out his brother. I don't know who did it. I don't care. But the fact of the matter is you cannot get documents from inside the company saying that they paid out 8 specific women and get a retracted memo from within the company without somebody in the company giving it to you.
Some high-profile actors have been speaking out, saying that Harvey Weinstein was inappropriate with them. Actress Rose McGowan, who accused Weinstein of sexual assault, has been vocal on Twitter, calling out those who she says have been complicit, like, she says, Ben Affleck and Matt Damon. Pretty big names there. Based on your Twitter account, it seems like you're definitely convinced that there is a cover-up. How deep do you think the cover-up goes in Hollywood?
I think it goes on all levels. I mean, you know, the big joke about the casting couch. First of all, it's not a joke. Second of all, it's been around for I don't know how long. You know, if something's not relevant and not happening anymore, you still don't use a term. I think it's going on every day in every different levels. There have been other people who have had allegations against them. But, you know, until if you're still powerful, it's hard to take them down. I do believe that the only reason this came out now, because Harvey wasn't that powerful anymore. If he was still getting 5 Oscar nominations a year, 5 to 10, or ruling the Oscars, would this have happened? Probably not. And, by the way, let's talk about Rose McGowan, because she's given out some tweets in the past couple years that have basically pinpointed him. You know, there was a tweet that said something to the effect of, when your boyfriend sells your movie to your rapist. So there's a lot of hypocrisy going on a lot of levels.
I'm interested in this angle of journalism censorship and reporters, independent reporters and reporters who belong to big name news organizations, deciding not to run the story or being told that their story wasn't going to run. Another reporter, Ronan Farrow, contributor to The New Yorker, was on Rachel Maddow. He said that he faced a lot of pushback from multiple news outlets.
There are now reports emerging publicly about the kinds of pressure that news organizations face in this. And that is real. In the course of this reporting, I was threatened with a lawsuit personally by Mr. Weinstein.
As a reporter myself, I'm trying to wrap my head around how that would actually happen and how I would handle that situation. But what do you think about big news organizations like this possibly suppressing this story?
First of all, I do want to preface this with, in 2003, I had a book that came out that was a Miramax book. However, my book went to auction. There were 4 companies that bid on it, and I decided with Miramax because Jonathan Burnham was at the time there, and Jonathan Burnham is a publishing god, and also Hilary Bass was the publicist, and she was amazing. I turned down the film and TV rights for the book from Harvey. That being said, there were a lot of people in the industry who had book deals. There was a reporter who had a documentary with Harvey. Everyone had some sort of consulting deals. And he would just pass them out willy-nilly.
Do you feel like there's an opportunity right now for actresses and actors, big name actors, to come out and speak to these allegations? And do you think it'll happen?
No, I don't think it'll happen. Absolutely not. Here's the thing. They want to work. All these guys know each other. It's a massive good old boy system. You want to work, you keep your mouth shut and hope it doesn't happen to you.
Paula Froelich was deputy editor of Page Six for 10 years. She's founder of AbroadAbroad.com. And now, faithful listeners, we leave the present behind and fast forward 50 years into the future. Welcome to 2067. While we don't have a time machine yet, and nobody's found a tesseract that we know of, we do have science fiction writers to take us there. Kristen Simmons is a young adult author. Her latest book, Pacifica, about a flooded world, comes out next spring. Much of her work is shaped by a painful family history, and her idea of the future is no different. In 2067, Simmons imagines an Earth altered by climate change, with disappearing coastlines, droughts, and rampant disease.
It's going to cause some tension, obviously, between people when the planet starts failing on us. Someone from the EPA told me that every year 8 billion tons of plastic goes into the ocean, and that that plastic breaks down into what they call microplastics, so these little beads of plastic. Those aren't stable enough to hold people right now, but in 2067, they may be. So you have, you know, larger pieces of trash, pieces of plastic that are holding together. You have netting,
string,
different kinds of fibers from clothes that start to net these pieces of plastic together. I think they may become solid enough to actually live on. I have a feeling that it will be the poor people who are displaced there, because I think our country has a history of displacing poor people. During World War II, a lot of Japanese Americans were considered hostile by the U.S. government, and so they were relocated into internment camps. My great-grandmother, Haru Tanaka, was moved into an internment camp in Crystal City, Texas. So the whole family was split up. But that's been what's informed my whole life, is this idea that because of who you are, you could be subject to removal. The way it worked with my great-grandmother is it was purely based on race. And I think that the same thing will happen if we're not careful in the future. I think that's a big thing that we need to be wary of. I hope that we will not see an increase of divisions, but I think that has kind of been our history, especially in this country, is that when things get tough, for instance, the world falling apart, we tend to look at what divides us rather than unites us. When really, with something as significant as climate change, we really need to be coming together to figure out how to solve these problems, how we're going to feed people, how we're going to live in a world that's kind of turning to trash in a lot of places. You know, and I think there will be some great things that'll come out of this. I'm hoping that we will have more efforts to do things like clean up the oceans, that we will have scientists that are going to come together to create things like the artificial pollination systems that will help grow hardier crops, that will be able to withstand the weather changes, that will develop vaccinations to things like malaria, and that they will be available for all people, not just the people who can afford it or get to it the fastest. I think for this to happen, we need to raise a younger generation to rely on each other more, to not pay attention to those things that divide us, but to the things that connect us, and how we can all work together to solve some of these problems.
Author Kristen Simmons, imagining the world 50 years from now. Her upcoming book, Pacifica, is out this spring. And we'll continue to hear more visions of the future in our 2067 series on The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Staples, offering print and marketing solutions for businesses, including color copies and presentations, booklets and manuals, signage, and more. More details at Staples stores or staples.com/copy and print. Staples, it's pro time. By Westbridge Dual Diagnosis Treatment Centers, aspiring to help men with co-occurring mental illness and substance use disorders with a family-centered integrated treatment approach. More at westbridge.org. And Fracture, creating modern photo decor by printing their customers' photo directly on glass. A Fracture is image, frame, and mount all in one, available in a selection of square and rectangle sizes. Learn more at fracture.me.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Sarah Gonzalez here with you today. Back in the 90s, record numbers of people were illegally crossing the border from Mexico to California. What Californians decided to do about the undocumented immigrants and how that affected current immigration policy is the subject of the newest Retro Report. Producer Scott Michael spoke to Todd Zwillick about the political and economic environment in California that set the stage for an explosive fight over immigration.
The state was in the middle of a really bad recession, and at the same time, there was a big wave of immigration, both legal and illegal. And that combination proved to be a kind of toxic mix. And the big issue in 1994 was the cost of undocumented immigrants using government-funded social services.
You talked to one former political consultant in your piece, Robert Kiley, who got involved in the politics in California at the time around the issue of public benefits like you're talking about.
When you went to the hospital, to the emergency, they were full of people there that were from this country. They were illegals. They were getting medical services free. Schools were being impacted. Cities were being impacted.
Yeah, I think it was something that was really upsetting, you know, at a time when people felt like there just wasn't enough to go around, not enough jobs, not enough money. The fact that there were undocumented immigrants who were entitled to emergency medical care and free public schooling for their children.
So Robert Kiley was just one of the political operatives and politicians then who got involved in Prop 187. What was that?
Prop 187 was a ballot initiative that would have denied public services to undocumented immigrants. And the most controversial part of it was that it would have kicked undocumented children out of public school. This was a really emotional, really divisive issue and the central issue in California that year. And I think part of it was that it became something that felt like it was about more than just legal versus illegal. It started to feel like it was something that was about race and an attack on all Latino people.
What happened?
I mean, what you saw were some of the largest protests in state history against Proposition 187. And you saw, just like you're seeing now, people mobilizing against Proposition 187. And even though the initiative passed, a lot of those people who started organizing decided that that was the moment where they decided they wanted to get into politics and they wanted to get involved. And a number of those people are now in positions of power in California.
And so, Scott Michaels, we're talking about California in 1994. Washington is watching all of this in the biggest state in the union. And right after this, you see increased border enforcement, crackdowns, using police to enforce immigration policy, deportation skyrocket, but all under Bill Clinton, the Democratic president.
Yeah, I think Prop 187 added momentum to this sort of backlash that was building across the country. And there were proposals on a national level to start cutting back on not just illegal but legal immigration. And the compromise that the Clinton administration eventually signed on to was an increase in border security and new laws that made it easier to deport some immigrants.
So that being the case, Scott Michaels, when we listened to Robert Kiley, the political consultant, who at the top was talking about immigrants in the emergency rooms, using medical services, schools, and then you listen to the campaign rhetoric of the president today.
They come over to the border. They have the baby in the United States. We now take care of that baby. Social Security, Medicare, education. Give me a break.
There is this American story being told yet again. What's the lesson from the mid-90s?
I think the lesson is that anti-immigrant feeling, at least in California, didn't last for very long. And it led to something that I think the people behind Prop 187 didn't expect. And that is that California today is a very different place than it was back then. It's probably the most immigrant-friendly state in the country. It's hard to predict how what's happening today is going to influence what happens 20 years from now.
Scott Michaels, producer for Retro Report. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
You can see the full Retro Report on our website, thetakeaway.org. You hear this accordion? This is the sound of home for some people. Late last month, the Trump administration released its third iteration of the travel ban, limiting or banning entry into the U.S. from 8 countries. The latest ban is intended to go into effect October 18th. Dr. Sohel Sahravi, a postdoctoral student from Iran, is one of the many individuals directly caught up in this series of executive orders. Dr. Sahravi was supposed to start working in the United States 8 months ago, but that was before President Trump's first executive order suspended Dr. Sahravi's visa in January, putting his plans on hold. after joining a lawsuit challenging the ban and gaining support from local political leaders, Dr. Saravi had his visa restored in March, allowing him to join the lab of Dr. Thomas Michel, a professor of medicine and biochemistry at Harvard Medical School and a cardiologist at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston. Dr. Saravi arrived late last month and was welcomed at the airport by Dr. Michel, his colleague, and Dr. Michel's accordion, nicknamed Rosie. He was greeted with this Iranian folk song. Dr. Saravi says his arrival in the country that once rejected him was transformed by the warmth of his colleagues and their commitment to science, which he says knows no borders.
When I arrived to Logan Airport and I hear the beautiful voice of Professor Michel, I felt that I'm in my city, in my home, and also we didn't expect it to greet warmly like this.
How did the travel ban disrupt your life?
The travel ban was one of the worst news that I heard in my life up to now, and the executive order completely impacted my and my wife's life and destroyed many of our programs to travel to the United States, and also completely confused our internal programs for working in Iran, preparing the requirements for travel to Boston. I tried to come to United States about 2 years ago. After I received an acceptance from Professor Michel, just after my visa was issued, we faced a travel ban and my visa was suspended, and the visa issuance for my wife was delayed for about more than 8 months.
Dr. Michel, you helped fight for Dr. Saravi to come to the U.S. For those who think that someone else could have been hired for this job, a U.S. citizen maybe, why Sohel Saravi? What about him or his particular diabetes research did your lab need?
I think that we look at science as an international endeavor. The United States has been a destination for the best and brightest from around the world, and I think the impact on American science has been extremely positive. Sohail has distinctive techniques and interests and abilities. He's an accomplished young scientist. He's one of the top life sciences students in all of Iran. He's exactly the sort of person I would want to bring to my laboratory. When we are talking about people who are seeking to advance knowledge to try and improve health through biomedical research, the United States historically has played a major role in bringing these people here to contribute. For the past 50 years, looking back at the Nobel Prizes awarded in the sciences, almost half, 42%, have gone to American scientists. One-third of those scientists were immigrants. That's, I think, only one metric, but the role of the U.S. as a magnet for advances in research is historic and important and is under threat both internally from the suppression of science and the restrictions in science funding, as well as internationally by the restrictions placed upon scientists who wish to come here to study and learn and contribute.
And you're concerned that the U.S. could be looking at the beginning of the end of its leadership in science?
I think it's already begun. I think in the last year, the number of international students applying for entry to United States colleges has gone down by 14%. Our own students are going to be seeking other paths and other countries in which to pursue their interests. People will go to Canada, they'll be going to China, they'll be going to Germany, they'll be going to other countries if they're interested in pursuing that as a research and career direction. And I do think that we're looking at an American loss.
Dr. Saravi, what do you hope to accomplish during your time here?
Many things. I should say that I want to research in the field of cardiovascular diseases. About 80 million people dead because of cardiovascular diseases, representing about 31% of all global mortalities. The report is same as Iran report. Last year in 2016, About 39% of all mortalities in Iran was caused by cardiovascular diseases. It shows that Iran and United States have same enemy. The enemy is cardiovascular diseases. So at this moment, we are in the same boat and we stand in one line. Now I'm here to work hard and to find a way to solve this huge problem which impacts the life and lifestyle of many people whole world.
Had you been to the U.S. before?
No. Just for first time, I'm here, yeah.
So what do you think?
I think that United States is an amazing country. I can do many works in my field of research. In conclusion, I feel so good.
And Dr. Michelle, you helped fight for Dr. Zarabi to come to the U.S. How do you challenge a Trump visa suspension? Is this something others can do when the new travel ban goes into effect October 18th?
I think it's a requirement for all Americans who view this policy as misguided to ensure that their concerns are adequately communicated to our leadership. This continuation of restrictions will make America less great, will degrade its science, will reduce its moral standing in the world, and ultimately the country will become weaker from this.
Dr. Thomas Michelle is a professor of medicine and biochemistry at Harvard Medical School and a cardiologist at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston. And Dr. Sohail Zarabi is a postdoctoral fellow from Iran working in Dr. Michelle's lab.
Support for The Takeaway comes from LegalZoom.com, providing American business owners with legal advice through its network of independent attorneys available in all 50 states. More information available at LegalZoom.com/takeaway.
I'm Sarah Gonzalez here on The Takeaway. Todd Zwillick will be back tomorrow.
It was wrong for the last administration to declare a war on coal, and it's right for this administration to say that the war is over.
That was EPA head Scott Pruitt speaking from, of all places, Hazard, Kentucky on Monday as he announced a proposed rule to withdraw the Clean Power Plan. And on Tuesday, Pruitt signed that order, setting in motion the process to eliminate the signature domestic environmental regulation of the Obama administration. It's one of 19 environmental rules that are in the process of being undone. The Trump administration has sought to undo at least 52 environmental rules. 52. So the New York Times has chronicled all of them, breaking them down for us into three categories. The 25 environmental rules that have already been overturned, the 19 that are in progress, and 8 that are in limbo. Eric Lipton is the Washington correspondent for the New York Times. He's been following the Trump administration's environmental policies, and he joins me now. Hi, Eric.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Before we get into some of the other rules, let's start with the Clean Power Plan. What did the regulation actually seek to accomplish?
What it was trying to do is reduce carbon emissions and climate change in the United States by requiring states to come up with plans to produce energy with less carbon. And so each state was supposed to devise its own plan as a way to generate electricity. And the net result of these plans was going to be a significant reduction in the number of coal-burning power plants in the United States. The plan did not actually order that those facilities shut down, but that was going to be the net result.
And that plan wasn't actually scheduled to go into full effect until 2022. So what did Pruitt actually sign on Tuesday? What long legal and regulatory process did he kick off just to begin the process of undoing the Clean Power Plan?
I mean, all he has done so far is indicated his intentions to repeal the Clean Power Plan. And so he will need to come up, in addition to actually going through the process of formally repealing it, he's going to have to come up with an alternative, a replacement, because the federal government was ordered to address this issue. So he leaves himself extremely vulnerable to legal challenge if he does not have a coherent alternative, which he has not yet announced what that will be.
And the EPA has said that it would at some point consider a new rule to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, but there is no replacement ready to go?
That's right. I mean, it's a lot easier to go to Hazard, Kentucky, which is a coal community, and to announce in a crowd of supporters that you're going to terminate something that they don't like. It's entirely a different thing to actually come up with a legally defendable alternative, which you can get through the regulatory review system and then defend in court. And until he accomplishes that, he actually has not done very much.
Is it possible for the U.S. to reach the goal set by the Clean Power Plan even without it?
Well, in fact, the major utilities in the United States have been moving very quickly towards achieving the goals even before the regulation was fully in place. And to some extent, there are even some folks in the electric utility industry who question, you know, why is the Trump administration doing this now? This is not something that we actually need or want. But they are determined to repeal the Clean Power Plan for reasons that are not entirely clear. And they are now set on a course to accomplish that.
Now, there are 52 other environmental rules that the Trump administration is focusing on, according to the New York Times. And you guys break them down into the three groups. Let's go through some that have already been overturned. The Trump administration approved the Keystone XL pipeline. They rejected a proposed ban on a potentially harmful insecticide. Eric, what rules stand out to you that maybe don't grab headlines that are still worth following?
I mean, that number of rules, you know, the 52, this is as many as we could find. There are probably others out there that are smaller, but that is our count so far. But among the rules that are most important that the administration has rolled back, two of them have to do with the methane gas. Both the Department of Interior and the Environmental Protection Agency both passed rules at the end of the Obama administration to limit methane emissions from oil and gas operations. Methane is approximately 25 times more potent as a climate change contributing factor than carbon dioxide itself. And with a huge increase in natural gas production in the United States, there is more methane. And so there has been an effort to try to force the oil and gas companies to take more steps to prevent the leaks of methane, which is contributing to climate change. And both of those rules are now targeted for repeal, although both of them have also resulted in legal challenges. And the legal challenges are holding up the Trump administration's ability to actually kill those rules.
Eric, these rollbacks, these 52 environmental rules that are being undone, they are benefiting some people or some industries. Who stands to gain here? I mean, the New York Times has reported that Pruitt has daily meetings with the oil and gas industry.
Yeah, I mean, you know, what is apparent with a lot of what's going on in this administration is how the regulated parties, you know, really have close ties and have access to the new administrators themselves. And in this case, I mean, you have oil and gas companies that stand to benefit from these changes. You have farmers and also, you know, agribusiness, large corporations that operate large-scale agricultural operations. You also have pesticide manufacturers. And so a lot of the same companies that have been into Pruitt's office are the companies that stand to benefit from these changes.
Eric Lipton is the Washington correspondent for the New York Times. Thanks so much, Eric.
Thank you.
That's our show for today. But before we go, we look ahead once again to the future. We've been hearing from many of you in response to our 2067 series, which imagines the world 50 years from now.
This is David in North Miami Beach, Florida, listening to WLRN. By 2067, I imagine a hot, humid dystopia, with the coastlines receding, forcing some people onto boats, or people on land fighting for fewer square feet to live on.
Hi, my name is Loretto. I'm calling from Color Bay, Florida. And I think the majority of people will be of mixed race, making it difficult to single out specific groups. But there will also be voluntarily segregated groups of folks that only want to coexist with folks of their own race.
What's your vision of the future in 2067? More hopeful than these listeners, I hope? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or head to the Takeaways Facebook page. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Sarah Gonzalez. Todd Zwillick is back tomorrow. This is The Takeaway.